You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 234, Donald Trump. He's beyond satire, but should he be banned from the UK? We examine whether the relationship between sport and the media is way too close. And this week, Chris Evans and Ferran Cotton presented the BBC Music Awards. But does anyone care who wins? All coming up after Prefab Sprout and Cars and Girls. Lucy dreams, life's a highway, too many roads, bypass my way. Or they never begin. Innocence, common grief, at the hands of life's stinking car thief. That's my car. Does heaven wait all heavenly over the next horizon? Look at us now. Some things hurt more, much more than cars and girls. Just look at us now. What adds up the way it did when we were young? Just look at us now. Some things hurt more, much more than cars and girls. Drive through a dust bowl. What's it do a young soul? We are deeply concerned. Someone stops for directions. Something responds deep in our engines. We have all. Hurt more, much more than cars and girls. Just look at us now. What adds up the way it did when we were young? Look at us now. Some things hurt more, much more than cars and girls.
Some things hurt more, much more than cars and girls, but I can't think of anything, but maybe there is. welcome to podcast 234. 30th of April 2011, we started this.
Wow, everything was different then, wasn't it?
But it really was.
People walked in the road in front of cars with red flags, and everything was in black and white.
Children were out on the streets hula hooping.
No, people left their front doors open terminally. They never shut their front doors. They were always open, even though people walked to school in 8 miles of snow.
It just proves you never know what you're getting yourself into in this life. I remain Terence Stackham, and she is not a car. She's a girl. She's Juliet Harris.
That's a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much indeed. That's genuine in my sincerity, I think.
Jules, by breakfast time this morning, a petition on the UK Parliament's website requesting that entry to the UK be denied to Donald Trump had reached over 500,000 signatures. This followed remarks by Trump, the US Republican Party candidate, let's remember, that if elected president in a year's time, he would order, I quote, a complete shutdown of all Muslim immigration to the United States, unquote. He later went on to say that parts of London and Paris are so radicalised, his word, that police officers are virtually unable to enter. Now, it's fairly common over here in the UK for us to scoff at Mr. Trump and consider him a figure of fun. But today's New York Times reports that a poll conducted jointly by themselves and CBS News finds Donald Trump lifted to an ever new high among Republican voters. So, Jules, maybe it's time we all took Donald Trump more seriously.
That is a depressing thought, I must admit, but I do see your point. He's an interesting one, Donald Trump, isn't he? I remember I read a book when I was younger. I can't remember the name of the chap that wrote it, so apologies not to credit him, but it was called something like The Very Bloody History of Britain, and it was kind of a history book for children, but it did have some quite adult humour. I don't mean postcard stuff. I mean, you know, quite sort of sophisticated humour. And he did a 1945 to now follow-up, and the follow-up was excellent. And there was a description of Arthur Scargill, former NUM leader, as being a funny man that looked like he was wearing someone else's hair. And for me, I suspect Donald Trump might be wearing Arthur Scargill's hair. Someone described him as nylon-haired on the internet earlier, which I thought was perfect. Despite the somewhat bizarrely coiffured Mr. Trump, it's odd, isn't it? I can't believe. I mean, firstly, what the petition itself, I think, it might be interpreted as a sort of a knee jerk reaction, a kind of we should ban him from coming here. And I'm tempted to say, isn't that terribly illiberal? Actually, I think the petition is a joke in the sense that it's a snark at the fact that he said people can't come into America, so they've said, well, in which case let's ban Donald Trump. I'm interpreting it as a sort of a eyebrow lifting joke that's gone a bit awry, rather than necessarily an illiberal attack on someone that the left happens not to agree with. And there's a lot of that about at the moment, so I'm happy to interpret. But this is a joke that went awry. But the politics of Donald Trump depresses me. We're seeing a sort of perhaps a slight nascent rise of the far right in various parts of the world. I mean, we could tie this into what's going on in France and the Le Pen or Le Pen and the National Front sort of lead in the polls this week. I don't like Donald Trump. I don't like Donald Trump's views. You quote this poll saying, he view of Republicans. There's a certain type of Republican that takes this view of Donald Trump that is pro-Trump. There's an awful lot of moderate Republicans. There are almost, in a way, parallels with Corbyn, except to the other end of the political spectrum, in that there are very core constituencies of this sort of electorate, the selectorate, the Republicans, for whom they love these views and they chime with them, and they don't mind how this looks to the general public. And there are an awful lot of moderates who are aware of how electable people are in certain areas and who are finding this difficult to swallow. I mean, there are parts of America that are very, very keen on this, but there's an awful lot of moderate Republicans that think this might prove to be unelectable. And I'm fascinated by the parallels of Britain and whether or not, you know, not in terms of the Muslim population, but the parallels of the political landscape, and whether or not we're looking at a situation where you've got someone that's pitching hard to their selectorate, which then falls flat in a general electorate, or whether they are onto something. I don't know.
Well, taking that point that you said that, you know, there's various degrees of political views within the Republican Party. You know, America has probably never been further split in its political thinking. Here in Europe, we probably see and hear more from the rather liberal viewpoints expressed in the media centres of New York and Los Angeles. So, you know, Republicans don't have much traction in California, for example. But from that New York Times report...
I've not seen the report.
So here's a quote from Bettina Norden, who's a 60-year-old farmer in Springfield, Oregon. Now, here's a quote that the New York Times came back with. Talking about Trump, he'll keep a sharp eye on those Muslims. He'll keep the Patriot Act together. He'll watch immigration, stop the Muslims from immigrating, end of quote. Now, anyone who's spent time in America knows that the TV news gives over maybe 20 seconds for foreign news.
Yes.
And most Americans don't have a passport. So it's fairly easy, I think, to whip up fear. And so, therefore, I think Muslims, you know, it's almost like they're a byproduct, because he could have said Mexicans, Muslims, Martians, and many Americans will reach for their guns and vote through fear for a fellow like Donald Trump.
And it's quite possible. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, as far as I'm aware, he doesn't have the nomination yet, does he? They're still in the middle of selecting. It'll be interesting to see if he gets it or not. I mean, I have to say that it seems to be rather a thin race, doesn't it, really? I mean, there doesn't seem to be... I know I talked a bit about Carson, and I can't remember who it was now, but one of our listeners sent me a very interesting link, which I learnt more about him. But he seems to be...
He seems to have even more worrying views.
I know,
but sorry,
he seems to be coming apart. Yeah, no, I agree. He seems to be sort of coming apart a bit as well. So it'd be interesting to see what happens. I have to say, I might live to regret saying this, but I can't see anybody pushing ahead of Hillary Clinton. I know there is a bit of a move behind Bernie Sanders, but I can't really see him getting the nomination ahead of Hillary Clinton. So I think that Hillary Clinton is, well, I think she's very plausible. So it'd be interesting to see if it's Clinton versus Trump. Then Clinton is genuinely a grown-up, I think, and it will be interesting to see what happens when Donald Trump comes up against a grown-up. It will be interesting to see if there's, you know, if there's any blowback from Bill Clinton. You know, what will happen? I mean, yeah, I find the rise of people like Trump extremely worrying, and not just because I don't agree with their views, but because they seem to be so ill-informed in their views. I mean, they don't seem to be rational views. I mean. And again, you know, if it was a more moderate Republican, I might find that easier to sort of contend with. I'm not sure. He does make George Bush look like a bit of an intellectual heavyweight, doesn't he, really? Which is a bit of a concern. And also, I was very amused by where I say he's ill-informed. He was tweeting about London's Muslim problem and Britain's Muslim problem, to which I feel like saying, you know, do me a favour, love, you know, what do you know about this? And he then talked about the highly respected British columnist Katie Hopkins, which I'm not entirely, I think even people on Katie, but even people on the right find Katie Hopkins to be somewhat implausible. So if this is Donald Trump's sort of grasp of world affairs, then I have to say I don't find it to be particularly plausible. But we'll see what happens. I mean, I am sort of slightly sad-faced about it, I must admit. But we'll see what happens. As you say, there's an awful lot of people in America who are very sheltered in their views and closed off in their views, and it might be that he plays well. We'll see how many other sorts of people there are in America. It's impossible to say at the moment, isn't it? And that's we're living in a kind of world now with the sort of it seems like it's a more insecure world than ever, and it's a more connected yet a more disconnected world than we've ever lived in, I think. Who knows? In you know, 5 years ago we would have said, oh, he's ridiculous. You know, he's not going to get anywhere, is he? And in today's very uncertain climate, it's impossible to say whether it will work or not. I hope it doesn't, but we'll see.
The other fellow to keep an eye on the Republican side, Trump, Carson against Clinton. Yes, there's a fellow called Ted Cruz.
Yes, he seems to be sort of getting a bit more coverage. But the problem is there are so many of them, aren't there?
He's just one of those sort of super smooth-looking fellows with his hair parted, you know, in the right way, and just the right smile and just the right amount of hair gel. And, you know, he's 45 years old, he's married, he's got two kids. But he's interesting in that he was actually born in Alberta, Canada.
Oh, okay.
And so it's only with a change in the law in America that he's now able to stand for prison for quite some time until relatively recently. You know, you had to have been born in the United States.
Wasn't Obama born in Kenya or something? Or
he was born in Hawaii.
There's always been a bit of a thing, yes, hasn't there, about whether or not he was born then. Of course, Ted Cruz has been in the news today. I'm just trying to look the story up now because I recognise he's... There's been a sort of a debate about on The Guardian about sort of access of emails and data mining from people from the campaign, data mining and something to do with the UK people's emails or something. So it'd be interesting to see if that story develops or not. Having just Googled it, it didn't come up in the kind of the news alerts thing. Oh, here it's only come up as a Guardian thing. It says Ted Cruz using firm. I see this is a sort of a non-story, I suspect now. Ted Cruz using firm that harvested data of millions of unwitting Facebook users. And it says documents reveal donor-funded US startup embedded in Republicans' campaign paid UK university academics to collect psychological profiles on potential voters. So it'd be interesting to see if that goes anywhere or not. It has the whiff of a non-story to me, but who knows?
Well, he's a former policy advisor to George W. Bush, which is probably all we need to know. But I think that the most critical part of his appeal is that he comes from a Hispanic background. Mm. And, of course, with now America heading towards a majority of Hispanic. Yeah. So, you know, he would have appeal, I'm afraid, if you're going to go for racial profiling, yes, then I'm afraid that his appeal, you know, would be wider than either Carson or indeed Trump.
Well, if you're a senator, and again, parallels with what's going on with Labour over here at the moment, the other end of the political spectrum, you know, there's a difference between who you think will be electable and who appeals to the people that are selecting you. Selectorates and electorates are different, same, discuss.
We're back looking at the relationship between sport and the media right after this cheering tune from 1989.
Walking in the rain just to get wet on purpose. I've been forcing myself not to forget just to feel worse. I've been getting away with it all my life.
Getting away.
However I look, it's clear to see that I love you more than so worthless. I'm an original sinner, but when I'm with you, I couldn't care less. Tell you shouldn't really know. And it's been true. Myself just to suggest that I'm selfish.
I've been trying to impress, that more is less and I'm repressed. I should do it instead. However I look, it's clear to see I love you more than you love me. However I look, it's clear to see I love you more than
of Bernard Sumner, Johnny Marr and Neil Tennant. It reached number 12 in the UK in 1989. I had to check that because in my mind it was a number one.
In a sane and sensible world, it would have been number one every week for an entire... It would have done a Brian Adams, wouldn't it? It would have been number one every week for the entire... So they are the most super of supergroups, aren't they? You know, what a perfect lineup. You've got, in a way, you've got 1980 to 1998 sort of sewn up in that lineup, haven't you, really? That's perfect.
You really do. Electronic, Getting Away With It. On Tuesday, Wolfsburg of Germany effectively knocked Manchester United out of the Champions League.
Yes, brackets, lol, close brackets.
TV, radio and the press all reported on the game in the manner one would expect, analysing how it all went for Louis van Gaal's Red and White Army. I thought it might make a change to look at a different aspect to what happened on Tuesday night in Wolfsburg. One of my friends, a long-standing friend, is a senior sports writer for one of the UK's daily newspapers.
Oh, okay.
He's increasingly frustrated, I spoke to him after Tuesday, by an element of his job, and that is an almost non-existent relationship with the players and officials at any of the Premiership football clubs. We probably all know that after football matches, players leave the dressing room and heading for the team bus, they pass through a mixed zone where reporters generally get behind a barrier.
I was going to say, I'm picturing crash barriers as we speak.
There are crash barriers, but they hope to grab at least a sentence or a soundbite from the passing players. Now, my friend from one of the more serious newspapers tells me that it's increasingly
a big one
common,
rather than a little one.
It's a big newspaper for players to don beanie hats, sunglasses and massive headphones.
Yeah, Beats, yeah. Inevitably, I should think.
Exactly.
Yes.
And to sail through that mix zone without a second glance and not a word to the waiting pressman. However, what made his blood boil, to coin a cliche, on Tuesday evening was the behaviour of one particular young Manchester United player who's barely played a handful of games but was featured for Man United on Tuesday. What he did was he actually unleashed, as the saying goes, a torrent of four-letter words and abuse at the waiting sports reporters, who merely asked him for a quote. They just shouted out his name and said, can we just ask you, about tonight's game? And he reacted in the most appalling way ever. Now, there's no excuse for bad manners, Jules, but, no wonder that the press are getting weary of this whole procedure.
Well, it's It is difficult, isn't it? If you've just played a football game and you've lost quite an important game and you've already got sort of, you know, various things being written in the press about you, yes, perhaps it might not be the cheeriest thing to do to speak to the waiting pressmen afterwards. But then having said that, unfortunately, that's the way of the world. It doesn't take a lot just to lob a sentence across, does it, really? And well, you know, people have got to do jobs, haven't they? And that's tricky. And you know, I wasn't there, so I don't know what the press said. But if it is as your friend says it is, then I don't think that's acceptable at all, really. And I'm sorry for them, really. And increasingly, it would seem that we feel a very, very long way away from the olden days where I don't know if this ever happened or if people are just misty-eyed about it, when the players used to go to the pub with the fans afterwards. Days of when Manchester United were Newton Heath, that used to happen all the time. And I don't know if it did or it didn't, but we do seem, you know, the problem is it spins off itself. The players are increasingly closeted away and lead increasingly parallel lives, not just to fans, but to everyone else, it would seem, including the press, as a result of which the press are rather hostile about that, which then makes the players hostile towards the press. And you've got this horrible sort of cycle that never seems to end, really. I don't really know what to say or what to suggest. Really, I don't think it's right to swear at people that are trying to do their jobs. I think it's a very great shame.
Let's look at it another way, because it would be easy to say that money is at the root of all this. You know, it seems unique to me to football in the UK, because ever since the birth of the Premier League and huge sums invested by Sky, latterly BT Sport, and Satanta at some stage.
Oh, God bless Satanta. They were a star.
They tried.
They were a star that burnt brightly yet briefly in the sky, weren't they?
And of course, you know, alongside of that, players' salaries have rocketed, and tandem with this, of course, their egos have been allowed to rocket also.
And of course, there's a whole circus around football now, isn't there? You don't just turn up and play anymore. You've got nutritionists and all fitness staff, and it seems like not just money, but they live in a bubble, really.
But yeah, let me put it to you in a sort of wider context, because, you know, players, yes, exactly. Well, they've come to believe that, you know, they're the geese laying the golden eggs. And we, you know, the mere spectators and the journalists who want to write about football, we're merely sort of flim-flam, flotsam and jetsam, who form part of the backdrop against which they perform. Now, but yet, if you take American sport as an example, American footballers, baseball players, hockey players, they're contracted to speak in this mixed zone, and reporters often have full access to the dressing rooms. You know, so we mentioned the Super Bowl, I think it was last week, the American football Super Bowl. You know, it astonishes me when I watch the coverage of American football, not soccer, but American football, that, you know, the reporters are in the dressing rooms.
They're everywhere, aren't they? I've seen it before. I mean, I think that's going a bit far, I must admit. I think, you know, I think there's some places ought to be sacred. I mean, I have to say, as regular since I work in the law, there's a thing in the Law Society Gazette, which is our trade publication, where they have Lawyer of the Week, which I've had some colleagues in the past who rather pathetically kind of fought over it with their big cases to try and get into it. I couldn't care at all. But it's one thing wanting to be Lawyer of the Week. I don't mind talking to the Law Gazette if they decided that I've had a high profile case and I'm Lawyer of the Week. But if they walked into my office and were sat in my office whilst I was trying to exchange contracts or something, I might object to that. So I if they were turning up in the dressing room, I have to say, I think that's strange. I think that's very odd. I'm not a fan of that. But I suspect what you might be going on to say is that, you know, the point I will make is without the fans and without the press, no one would care about football, would they? Really, they need us, don't they?
There's the rub, because, you know, all I was going to say about the American thing is the interviews with players seem to be carried out with mutual respect. Mm-hmm. And American sportsmen, less so women, it has to be said, are paid astronomical salaries. And yet it seems to be part of the contract. But we've allowed players to receive these huge sums, but without really getting, you know, the balance back of what we get for them receiving, you know, £250,000 a week. But I just think that Manchester United young player, you know, he really should remember it's a long way down.
Absolutely. I think that's right. Although the only thing I would say to flip it round, and this is not so much aimed at the big papers as it is little papers. Of course, yes, players are, you know, behave like gods, don't they? And that's not right. And, you know, they act as if they're gods, and that's not right. But of course, the tabloid newspapers, obviously we have less, tabloids than we used to, but they very much, you know, they love the fact that they can occasionally get stories out of these players behaving like God's kiss and tells in the olden days. And also, you know, of course, I'm surprised there aren't, I mean, I don't read the tabloids, but because I follow various people on Twitter that tweet newspaper headlines, I'm aware of what goes on. And I'm surprised that there aren't more kiss and tells nowadays, actually, in the rise of social media, and particularly the fact that everybody's got a camera and a video camera on them all the time nowadays in their phone. But one thing I would say is that, of course, it does give the tabloids lots of column inches and sales when these sort of godlike, disconnected from reality players do things like, who was the chap that took the laughing gas? I can't remember who it was now, but people...
Oh, the Aston Villa fellow, Grealish?
I don't know, there's been several of them, haven't there? There might have been a Bong Lahore, I don't want to miss it, it's not reliable anymore, but there were some players that did get laughing gas and got caught doing that. Mm. So, of course, yes, it's terrible that players sort of swear at the press and you know, are not very nice, but equally, the press are very keen to get stories out of them when things go wrong, and perhaps if you know, if it's not happened to you as a player, but if it's happened to your mates in the dressing room, sometimes you get footballers that are mates with players in other teams. If it's happened to a mate of yours that you play against, perhaps you might be a bit wary of the press as a consequence. So I'm inclined to agree with you, but there is also always a flip side.
But just one other quick point on that, Jules, is that... you know, this incident on Tuesday night. Now, if that had happened in another walk of life, yes, that would have been sprawled over page. And also the thing about you saying about kiss and tells not being reported. I suspect, it's just my point of view, I suspect that the newspapers know that if they had gone all over that player, yes, on Tuesday night, who behaved appallingly, they wouldn't get the courage. They'd be banned. You know, Alex Ferguson was famous for saying, "Oh, you're banned for a year." Newcastle as a club are famous. You know, they were infants,
and I was actually going to go on to say that, of course, I do understand the dilemma that papers are in, because when you've got
but they shouldn't.
I completely agree. I think it's completely wrong, and I think that Sir Alex SAF, as he's known, I think his behaviour with the BBC, where he wouldn't talk to them for donkey's years because of that thing to do with the Sun and the football agents and Panorama, I thought that was appalling. I thought that was really, really rubbish. And, you know, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. They have a fear that they're not able to talk to people. But at the same time, they shouldn't do it. It's difficult. I was just making the argument that, of course, you know, if you've had papers published, you know, intrusive things about you, perhaps you wouldn't be incredibly cheery about speaking. But having said that, Wayne Rooney always seems to be pretty sort of, you know, pretty okay at talking to the press, and they've published some terrible things about him. And again, I always seem to be a bit of a defender of Wayne Rooney on things every time I talk about football. But I think that Wayne Rooney's borne it pretty well, but I think that's because Wayne Rooney, you know, unlike your man at Manchester United now, realises which side his bread is buttered on, perhaps.
Maybe that's it. And even if absurd though it may seem to say in terms of Wayne Rooney, maybe it's a generational thing. And Wayne Rooney's 30. This young fella that I'm talking about, you know, is just 20, 21. So maybe, you know, again, it's to do with being gaining some sense as he is.
Quite possibly. Who knows? But anyway, I wish the young chap at Manchester United well. I hope he grows up a great deal in a small amount of time.
We'll be considering the value of the BBC Music Awards right after this from a group who describe themselves as a jangle and roll band from London. This is Chorus Girl.
I'm
That was a chorus girl from their debut album. That song is called "Oh to Be a Defector." I spoke last week on the podcast about Moss and Lime, or Moss Lime, who were a band that they were headlining at a gig that I DJ'd at recently. And Chorus Girl were the support, and I and the promoter were very, very impressed by Chorus Girl. We thought that they possibly have quite a big future. I think that track's been picking up some play from Six Music, and it's quite interesting. I was looking on Spotify and sort of seeing what songs were there, and it was quite obvious, which, because I hadn't heard it on Six Music, but the promoter had said to me, oh, when they started playing that song, oh, this is the one that was being picked up by Six Music. And when I looked at how many plays their songs had had on Spotify, this had had about 48,000, and the next one down had had about 2,000. So I thought that probably is the one that was played on Six Music. But no, they were very pleasant as a band, and I suspect they've got a big future. They, as my promoter friend put it, they really did live up to their name. It was chorus after chorus, so it'd be interesting to see what happens. It's possibly a "you heard it here first" moment, who knows.
Yeah, that's a great track, Chorus Girl, "Oh to Be a Defector." Jules, I haven't met Chris Evans since sometime back in the 1990s.
Well, the fact that you've ever met him at all puts you, as ever, one ahead of me in the celeb stage. Okay.
But I have a mutual friend in common with him, and I'm told that in private, with his friends, you could not find a kinder, more helpful and generous man, which is lovely, and we would all love to be thought of in
absolutely
such a vein.
Why wouldn't you? Yes.
However, why do all TV stations believe there's a law that only Chris Evans is allowed to present music and award shows? And why does dear Chris, why does he feel the need to yell throughout the proceedings?
I know.
However, bearing in mind that the BBC now considers popular music to be something that should be sidelined to BBC Four, with the occasional forbearance of allowing an hour at midnight on BBC Two or later with Jules Holland.
Indeed. I was going to say, if it's any comfort to you, the whole BBC Music thing could be hosted by Jules Holland instead, and I'm not entirely convinced how much of an improvement that would be. So yes, better the devil you know, possibly. But yes, carry on.
It seemed odd that suddenly the BBC finds pop music important enough for them to wheel out their second BBC Music Awards last night, at which, of course, Adele picked up the award for British Music Artist of the Year. Now, taking into account, Jules, that Wikipedia lists 51 different sets of British Music Awards, from the Brits through to the Young Fiddler of the Year.
Oh, wow. I want to go to that. That sounds amazing.
Not making it up, there really is that award. Is there any room for these BBC Music Awards? And also, who cares?
Well, exactly. And to start off, I don't know if it's still on or not, but I remember when I was growing up, the Music of Black Origin Awards, the MOBOs, used to get quite prominent coverage, I think, on Channel 4.
They're still going.
Yeah, I know they're still going, but I don't see any TV coverage of that anymore. And I think that's a real shame that the diversity of the awards that are covered seems to be narrower and narrower. The Mercurys are given huge prominence, aren't they? We spoke about them on the show previously. I couldn't bring myself to care, I must admit. We've sort of talked. I hate to reveal the magic behind what goes on, but we do talk about what we're going to talk about each week. And Terence emailed me and said, oh, you know, are you going to watch the BBC Music Awards? I am. And I hate to say it, but you said, oh, I'm watching it, so we can talk about it. And I thought, well, if Terence is watching it, he can talk about the fact he's watched it, and I can talk about the fact I haven't watched it, because I was at a tedious networking thing that involved pizza and Christmas jumpers, which we won't talk about. But I made it in at about 1 minute past eight, and the comments you have made about the Music Awards so far did not make me feel compelled to turn my television set on and watch it. And I think the combination of Chris Evans and Fern Cotton was enough to finish me off, really. I mean, I'm sure she's a perfectly nice lady, Fern Cotton, and I had a brief unhappy stint in an office, which one of the many reasons why I was unhappy is that the powers that be insisted that we have Radio 1 on every single day whilst we were sitting working. And I have to say, over 3.5 months of being subjected to daytime Radio 1, I did slightly warm to Fern Cotton and doing a daytime show by the end of it, but it was only slight and it wore off pretty quickly after I left. I almost object to Fern Cotton more than I object to Chris Evans. I object to both of them hosting this Music Awards, because neither of them have any interest in music at all. They're like Steve Wright, they're like Chris Moyles. One of the reasons why I'm increasingly, or rather I'm a decreasing listener to Chris Evans' breakfast show, is that he really does treat music as with contempt. And as a broadcaster that always tries very hard not to talk over records, to play records in full, to treat, you know, I do a show and the music is the star and I'm just telling people about the music. Chris Evans is always talking over records. He's always playing half a record. He was really unpleasant about Fleur East's single the other day, to the point where she was asked about it on This Morning. I don't like him, at all as a sort of, I don't buy him and Fern. Fern Cotton's the sort of person that buys a Motorhead t-shirt in Topshop and then thinks they're a music fan. She knows Pete Doherty. This is all we know about Fern Cotton's musical hinterland, because she tells us about that a lot, or rather she did in the days when knowing Pete Doherty was some sort of cultural currency.
Yet he has record-breaking levels of listeners.
Absolutely. I know, and this is what frustrates me, and I know that normal people are not like me, so that's probably what we can put it down to. But yes, I find music awards that could be an authentic music awards that's hosted by two people who as broadcasters have little to no interest in music at all. I find that curious. I could buy it if it was Laverne or someone like that who does have a musical hinterland, but you say, who cares really? It's just another set. I don't even care about the Brits anymore, and they've been going for forever, haven't they? So this kind of sort of new, fairly new invented, it's just a sort of a backslappy thing really. I know that the awards are that by their very nature, but I don't know. I can still bring myself to be interested in the Mercury in a way that I can't with these silly music awards.
Just as an aside, it's no surprise that both you and I had lost sight of the MOBO Awards, because they are featured on the urban wastelands of ITV2.
What?
Is where the television coverage.
Speaking of which, but ITV2 was a feature of one of my favourite ever sort of snarky comments. I think it was from the Guardian guy that, as a sort of a one-liner side in describing something, described the band Editors as an ITV2 version of Joy Division, which is still one of my favourite unkind snarks about a band.
It was very interesting watching the BBC Music Awards, perhaps not for the reasons that they would have hoped.
Well, no, I suspect so, yes.
In that the biggest screams from the audience, with the exception of One Direction, anything you say about music, always I speak, well, with the exception of One Direction, but the biggest screams from the audience were for Nick Grimshaw and Greg James, the Radio 1 DJs. And I think this may be quite a significant change. I don't recall Pete Murray or David Jacobs being screened over at a volume that, you know, beat the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. You know, now, and, you know, you talk about Chris Evans and, you know, whether he actually likes music or not. But, you know, it's that show is about him, not the music. And I wonder whether one could say the same to extent about Grimmy over on Radio 1 and Greg James.
Well, yes. And again, Greg James, I absolutely cannot stand as a presenter. I hate him. And one of the reasons I hate him so much is not because of his... I'm sure I've ranted about Greg James before on this programme, I think. But it's not because I don't think he's particularly interested in music. He does actually seem to have some interest in music. He rather famously went out with Ellie Goulding for a few years, I think, the singer. Oh, and right. And also, I've heard him make positive comments about records before, which I haven't with some of the other people we've talked about. I mean, he's talked about things like Clean Bandit, and he's got on board with things very early on and does genuinely seem... I don't share his musical taste, but he does seem to genuinely have interest. My main gripe with Greg James is that he's not anywhere near as funny as he thinks he is, but then I suspect that people probably say the same thing about me. So I agree with you. I mean, I suppose the screaming for Grimmy was partly due to the fact that he's on X Factor now, isn't he? So he has a sort of an outside music profile. And Greg James, I think, has done TV presenting before. I saw him do a clip show with Gabby. You see, this is how behind the times I am. I'm still calling her Gabby Urath, but she's not, is she? She hasn't been Gabby Urath for years. She's Gabby Logan. But they did a 50 best goals of the World Cup or 50 World Cup moments or some BBC Three clip show they presented together. So he's kind of broken out away from music presenting, and I think maybe that's why they were being screened at, because in the olden days, I don't know if people stuck to their music thing, but I remember people like Jacobs having posted stuff on TV. So I don't know what the answer to that is really, but I just know that I think this is a tedious waste of time is only my view. This is not like the Mercury, which is trying to do something, although again, you could criticise the Mercury for being far more mainstream than it used to be. I mean, when it used to first sort of be on, you used to have in the early 90s until 2003, you used to have a sort of a token classical nomination. And although it was seen as a token nomination, it was good, it was there. You used to have a sort of a classical album, a jazz type album, another sort of out there album. And it does, the Mercury seems to itself have become quite narrower nowadays. But it's such a pity that, of course, you know what the big acts are going to be. You know that Adele's going to win things. I mean, I think it's pretty well deserved, really, to but it turns into the Brits. It turns into a bit of a sort of a selling fest, I think, really. I mean, yes, Adele, I think Adele is extremely talented, but you can't escape the feeling that she's also being rewarded for having sold an awful lot of units at the same time in a world where music doesn't sell as much as it used to. So, yeah, I find the whole thing a bit tedious, really. Maybe that's just me being tired and miserable, but I can't bring myself to care. I had a flatmate at university that every time he walked into our front room and the television was on, which was pretty much 24 hours a day, there would be some famous person on TV, and he wouldn't know them inevitably, and he would point to the screen and say, "Who is this and why should I care?" And I have to say, I've been a little bit about that with the Music Awards. Really. I don't know who most of the people... Well, I don't know why I should care about Chris Evans and shouting and Fern Cotton wearing a Motorhead T-shirt, really. It's not doing a lot for me, I must admit. Maybe I'm the wrong age. Maybe if I was a young person, I would be very excited about the fact that Grimmie and Greg James were there and I would want to scream a lot. I don't know, but it doesn't do a lot for me, I must admit.
Perhaps this is all the BBC can do now. It can't afford to bid for
this is the issue, isn't it? Yeah.
It can't bid for any important sports, so it's reduced to Sports Personality of the Year, which is it's essentially a clips show.
And actually, I saw a very telling comment from Catherine Flett, I think it was, a journalist who, funny enough, lives locally to me, but she's a national journalist, and she commented on Twitter that she said that she compared the BBC Music Awards to Sports Personality of the Year in that she said it had no real atmosphere. Someone said it felt like you were listening from the toilets 300 yards away, but waiting for your mates because the sound was so bad. That it felt like trying to build a sense of excitement. Maybe that's the shouting. That's a thought. I remember Paul Merton being on, I think it was him. He was on Room 101. Someone was on Room 101 once. I think it was Bruce Forsyth. And he wanted to put in presenters that shouted, and he rather politically incorrectly narrowed it down to women that shouted, but he had a germ of a valid point in there about shouty female about shouty presenters. And one of the clips they showed was there's a chap called Michael Underwood who was famous as a TV presenter, a children's TV presenter, and then went on to appear on Dancing on Ice, I think, or one of the reality things, and did very well. But he shot to fame because he entered a TV programme, a Search for a Star programme, to select a new children's TV presenter for the continuity strands, as they then had them on BBC. And they showed a clip from the final of this show, this climax, and Gabby Roslin was presenting. And she said, "And the winner is..." And there was a big, long pause. And as my dad always says, in the middle of any big, long pause, cheap television. And then and then Gabby Roslin went, "It's Michael!" and shouted really loudly. And Paul Merton said, maybe it was trying to build a sense of excitement that wasn't really there. And I think that might have been Chris Evans and Fern Cotton shouting, trying to build up an atmosphere. If there is an atmosphere somewhere, you don't really have to work to build it up, really. You just have to sort of tend to it. And I suspect that perhaps deep down Chris Evans knew that the game was up. Maybe that was why he was so shouty.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Yes, it was a BBC Music Awards. Yes, it's essentially it. Yeah, it's a clip show with some live performances chucked in and alongside a yelling host.
Yes. Your sort of thing, then do rush to iPlayer after listening to this.
You can be all over it. You can contact us if you would like to do so. The best way is to find us on Twitter, SuperJules84 for Juliet and Sir Terence for me. A lot of people contacted us this week, which was lovely. It was good to hear whether you like, the things you suggest or pick up on talking points. That's fine. George, you're on the radio this week.
I am. Twice, I know. Double trouble. We're recording this on Friday evening. I'm not sure when it will go out, but Saturday the 12th, so tomorrow evening in real time,
It will already be out
wow,
in the world.
Wow, how exciting. Yes. Well, in which case then, Saturday the 12th in the evening, 6 or 7, is the much anticipated by about four people, including Terence and my mum, Saturday Social Christmas special. So, yes, there will be Spectre, as they say. There will be Christmas-themed songs by sort of various Motown-y, moddy, Northern Soul-y type people. So that's on this week from 6 to 7. And then on the following Wednesday, it's Indie Wonderland. And it's the Indie Wonderland Christmas special next week as well, from 8 till 10. And my big fat Indie Christmas. I think this is the third big fat Indie Christmas that I've done. Great. So yes, what can I say? Bigger, fatter, India Christmasier. I'm not sure if that works, but that will be a thing that happens next week.
Huge thanks to Rona on her island, of course.
And I should have said it's on Barricade Radio. Sorry.
Barricade Radio.
BarricadeRadio.com. But of course, I very much support Rona and her island endeavours.
Absolutely. We'll see you next week. Now, Jules, if you'd given me a billion guesses to predict the playout track this week, I should never have guessed this one.
I don't know why I picked this, really. It's just a tune that always cheers me up, I think. And I've had quite a full on week. Listeners, I send Terence the two tunes, and sometimes I have little notes on where I think they should go. And this week I just didn't. And I was amused that you picked this as the playout track, because to me it's the sort of track that you would expect to be playing at the end of when you've been to the cinema, or if you've been to see a theatre show, and they put some music on to keep the atmosphere going, but to kind of calm everybody down and tell them that it's basically time to go home so that they can clear up. And this has that kind of vibe about it. I spent a lot of my life wishing I was in an early 1960s spy film, and this kind of makes me feel like that a bit, really. This is Keith Mansfield and Funky Fanfare.
You have been listening to a DAKAM Media production.